So I'd like to welcome you to this UCLA Lecture Series event. Bedros Dermatosyan, a very good friend of mine, is our distinguished speaker tonight. I'd like to say a couple of things about my program and myself first, not to promote myself, but to promote my program. Here, I am Sebo Aslanian, in case none of you have heard of me here. I'm the Richard Ovanesian Chair of Modern Armenian History, and been here for 3 years. We have a lecture series that runs throughout the year in the fall and the winter. And this particular term, we have a very healthy and vigorous lecture series where the speakers are, for the most part, addressing issues that are in some way obliquely or directly connected to the centenary of the Armenian Genocide that is coming up in April of this year. So just to give you a very quick rundown of some of the speakers that I have lined up, so that if you're interested, you could join us here. I can tell you that on February, our next speaker, in addition today, our next speaker will be appearing on February the 18th. It'll be Umit Kurt, a graduate student from the New England area. I think I forget the name of the university now. Clark, he will be Clark University, who will be talking to us about total destruction by despoliation, the role of the local and provincial elites in the annihilation and deportation of the Antab Armenians in 1915 to 1918. Following Mr. Kurt, we have a very illustrious novelist, Nancy Krikorian, who will be here for 2 lectures, one for us and one for another group, on February the 25th. Ms. Krikorian will be presenting her latest novel, which is based in Paris in the Nazi era and involves Armenians who are actively involved in the resistance. And if you're interested too, that lecture should also be around this time, so it's accessible to the larger community. We have also Dr. Stepan Asturian coming here on the 5th of March, followed lastly but not least by Dr. Rachel Goshkarian, who will be speaking to us on various issues connected to Armeno-Turkish or Armeno-Ottoman, a very distinct hybrid kind of literature that is based on the written language being Ottoman Anatolian Turkish, while the script, of course, being Armenian. So that is just a little sampling of some of the lectures later on this quarter. But I'd like to also say a couple of very quick things about a more important event that is coming up in April. On April the 10th and 11th, UCLA and the Richard Ovanesian Chair is organizing a major conference dedicated to the centenary of the Armenian Genocide, which will consist of a 2-day event. The first day is on the 10th of April, and we will have back-to-back panels in the morning, followed in the evening by our highlighted event, which is an evening of keynote lectures. 3 distinguished lectures will be reflecting on the meaning and impact of the genocide, the 100th anniversary of the genocide in their academic lives, and the speakers will be Ron Suni of Michigan, our very distinguished historian, Richard Ovanesian, followed by a third speaker who is coming specially from Turkey, and that will be Murat Belge, who is a literary critic, comparative translator of various works from James Joyce to William Faulkner and so on, and also a very well-known public intellectual in Turkey. So these 3 speakers will be speaking at Schoenberg Hall for 3 hours. The event is 3 hours long. It'll be accompanied by classical music. Armenian a musical ensemble based here at UCLA will be performing for us, followed by then the following day of, again, back-to-back panelists, some of whom are clearly the best in the world in the field of genocide studies. People like Jay Winter, Dirk Moses, Donald Bloxham, and the name is escaping now, but I can guarantee you that it's going to be a very distinguished gathering of intellectuals and scholars of the genocide. So I hope that you will all make it. There's a piece of paper that's been making its rounds, I hope. Please fill it out if you want to be on our mailing list, if you're not already there, so you can receive the an update of all the events that the chair is holding this year and for the years to come. So now let me switch to the event that we have tonight. Our distinguished speaker, Dr. Bedros Dermatosyan, does not need an introduction to most of you here.
Okay, we're done.
Yes. But nonetheless, I will still say a few words. Bedros is originally from Jerusalem. I met him, we went to school together. We graduated from the same place at Columbia University. I think I met him in 1998 or 99, I'm not sure. And we've been in touch since then. He is a remarkable human being. But in addition to that, he's also an excellent, exceptional scholar who wears multiple hats, multiple linguistic hats, including reading Ottoman Turkish, modern Turkish, Arabic, Hebrew, Ladino, and probably a few others that that are escaping me at the moment. But his recent book is called Shattered Dreams of Revolution. It's an analysis of the 1908 revolution in the Ottoman Empire and the hopes and aspirations that it promoted among the some of the minorities, in quotation marks, in the Ottoman Empire, including the Armenians, the Arabs, and the Jews, as well as the Greeks, although he doesn't really mention the Greeks that much. So we are very happy to have him here today. Today is our book. He's going to be talking about his book. When his lecture is done, we have still a few of his books that remain for sale in case anybody is interested and hasn't been able to get a chance to buy his books. You can come up to the gentleman in the back or to Bedros, who can also give you a special rate if you want, if you're nice to him. So with all due, so please join me in welcoming Dr. Matosyan. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Aslanian, for this fabulous introduction. How much it's genuine, but you maybe exaggerated. But thank you very much. I would like to thank. I'll speak up now. I said a couple of. I would like to thank the Richard Tovanisyan Chair. First of all, I would like to thank Professor Aslanian for inviting me here to give the talk. I would like to invite the Richard Tovanisyan Chair for organizing this talk, and also the Near Eastern Studies, the Grumbaum Center for co-sponsoring the event. So basically, I'll be talking about the book that came out a couple of months ago about the Young Turk Revolution as viewed by three non-dominant groups. I call them the non-dominant groups: Armenians, Arabs, and Jews. So basically, the book is divided into six chapters. The first chapter discusses the symbolism and revolutionary festivities, an analysis of the symbolism and revolutionary festivities that took place after the 1908 revolution. The second chapter discusses a very important aspect of the revolution, which is the political discourse. How do people in post-revolutionary period discuss the future of that society that's experiencing the revolution? Third chapter will discuss the impact of the revolution on changing the dynamics of power inside among these groups, and how these groups internalize the Young Turk Revolution by creating their own ancien regimes, their own new beginnings, and envisioned future for their own communities. The fourth chapter discusses the electoral politics that took place among these different groups. Discusses the competition between and among these different ethnic groups. Chapter 5 discusses the parliamentary politics, the way in which these different ethnic groups debated about issues pertaining to their own communities within the Ottoman parliament. And the final chapter deals with the unfortunate outcome of the revolution, which was the counter-revolution, and concentrates a bit on the Adana massacres of 1909, but I only discuss the Adana massacres in six pages. It would be the subject of the second book project that I'm working on. So I'm just going to tell you how we're going to proceed now. I'm going to provide the historical background about the Armenians in the 19th century Ottoman Empire. Then I'm going to discuss the impact of the Young Turk Revolution on the Armenians in the empire. Then I'm going to discuss one of the major issues that came about after the Young Turk Revolution, which is the question of the Armenian provinces. By Armenian provinces, I mean the eastern provinces within the Ottoman Empire. And then we're going to discuss the Armenian political parties in the post-revolutionary period. Of course, after the Young Turk Revolution of 1908, it became a huge opportunity for all the political groups of different ethnic communities to come back and be legitimate parties and be part of the political system. Then I'm going to move on to the Jewish community and discuss the struggle within the Jewish community in terms of ecclesiastical struggle between the different parts, different rabbis within the Ottoman Empire. And then after that, I'm going to discuss the impact of the Young Turk Revolution on Zionism and the way in which Zionism viewed the Ottoman Revolution as an ultimate opportunity to reach their final goal, which is the establishment of a Jewish homeland in Palestine. Then I'm going to discuss the impact of the revolution also on the Arab provinces and discuss the connection between the politics of the notables and the Committee of Union and Progress. Afterwards, I'm going to concentrate on one case study, which is the politics in Mount Lebanon and the way in which the Young Turk Revolution also creates major tensions in the Mount Lebanon area. I will do a minor conclusion based on this. So this is the third chapter of the book. I'm going to do a minor conclusion, but then towards the end, I'm going to do a grand conclusion of the book. What are the major points that conclusions that I arrived to? So I think the lecture is going to be 45 minutes, so bear with me. And we're going to start now. So 6 days after the revolution, the Young Turk Revolution, Pyzan Keçian, the editor of Byzantion, the Armenian daily in Istanbul, he wrote a lengthy article about the downfall of the Armenian patriarch, Marakya Ormanyan, 1896-1908, who was the patriarch of Istanbul between the years 1896 and 1908. And I quote, "The strong current of freedom took away Ormanyan." Keçian crowd, "A day does not pass when we do not see the collapse of a major representative of the ancien regime. It is true that we are living in a historical period, as it was for France in 1789 and in 1848 for all Europe," end quote. Keçian's words reverberated positively among some ethnic groups. For other groups, though, the period became a critical historical juncture that threatened their power, prestige, and status. Regardless of their outcome, revolutions profoundly change the dynamics of power within respective states and societies, and the 1908 revolution was no exception. For those disenfranchised people who were dreaming of freedom, equality, and justice, revolution became their savior, the means by which a new and a better future would be achieved, and by which they themselves would be freed from the shackles of tyranny. For those elites who were worried about the revolution, however, it became their worst nightmare, shaking the pillars of their authority and endangering not only their power, but also their survival. So the lecture will deal with the impact of the revolution on Armenians, Arabs, and Jews, three diversified ethnic groups representing vast geographic areas, meaning I do not concentrate on one geographic area, as well as a wide range of interest groups, religions, classes, political parties, and factions. It examines the way in which these groups internalized the revolution by creating their own ancien regimes, victories, and new era. In recent years, excellent macro-historical analysis have traced the impact of the revolution on the Ottoman state in terms of the transition of power from the Sultan to the Ottoman Parliament and the Committee of Union and Progress, the interplay between the constitution and the Shariat, the tension between the executive and the legislative authorities, and contention among the major political parties. In contrast, comparative examination of the revolution's impact on multi-ethnic component of the composition of the Ottoman society have been scarce. Such studies particularly challenging because the differences among the societal structures, religions, ethnicities, languages and cultures of these groups outnumber their similarities. A comparative cross-cultural examination of these groups would provide a better picture with regard to the impact and the impact of and reaction to the revolution. It would demonstrate how these different groups negotiate and redefine their positions by adapting themselves to and navigating through the new unstable period attained by the revolution, something that we see happening in every post-revolutionary period, even today after the Arab Spring. So a brief overview of the major transformation of Armenians, Jews, and Arabs experienced during 19th century in empire is necessary to a full understanding of the impact of the revolution had on these three non-dominant groups and how it changed the dynamics of power within these communities. One important point I would like to emphasize is that in the Ottoman administrative system, and this is known thing that the Armenians, Greeks, and Jews, unlike the Arabs, were organized in semi-autonomous bodies called millats. Under the millat system, these groups enjoyed a wide array of religious and cultural freedom, in addition to substantial legal, fiscal, and administrative autonomy. During the 19th century, the Ottoman Empire initiated a series of reforms to strengthen the political power and preserve the integrity of its territories under the rubric of defensive developmentism. This is very known in all Middle Eastern classes. We talk about this. In total, there were three reform periods. The second reform period, known as the Tanzimat period, which is Tanzimat means reordering, which started in 1839 and ends in 1876, had a profound impact on the non-Muslim groups in the empire. These reforms intended to secure the loyalty of the empire's Christian subjects at a time when nationalist agitations were rising in its European sections. Consequently, they aimed to mold the notion of Ottomanism by breaking down the religious and cultural autonomy of the millats. Despite failing to attain this goal, these reforms made substantial changes in the dynamics of power in the non-Muslim communities. They resulted in the promulgation of constitutions and establishment of national assemblies among the non-dominant groups. The era of Tanzimat reforms was halted by the regime of Sultan Abdulhamid II. With the arrival of his absolutist regime, the dynamics of power once more changed among these groups. In the case of the Armenians, the National Assembly was prorogued. Patriarch Matios Izmirilian was banished to Jerusalem for vehemently criticizing the Sultan's regime for the Armenian massacres of 1896. He was replaced by Patriarch Malakia Ormanian as the Patriarch of Istanbul. In the case of the Jews, Rabbi Moshe Halevi, who was appointed as the locum tenens of the Chief Rabbinate in 1872, was elected as locum tenens without any support by the local community, and he was backed by the conservative elements, and he refused to conduct elections until the Young Turk Revolution. On the other hand, as a result of Sultan Abdulhamid's policy of pan-Islamism that he promoted in the end of the 19th century, he appointed the most conservative Arab Muslims as his advisors. Thus, during the Hamidian regime, Arab provinces of the empire gained more importance. While these transformations were taking place, an opposition group was being consolidated in the empire. This group, calling itself the Young Ottoman Movement, emerged in the Ottoman Empire and its expatriate communities in the end of the 19th century. Their main political party, the CUP, the Committee of Union and Progress, became the dominant force within the movement. After 3 decades of relentless efforts and political activism, this group staged the Young Turk Revolution of 1908, reinstating the Ottoman constitution and opening the parliament. Thus, they launched what came to be known as the Second Constitution Period, which starts in 1908 and ends with the Ottoman defeat in World War I in 1918. So, within this context of the 19th century transformations, Armenians living in the Ottoman Empire experienced 4 major transformations: emergence of cultural nationalism as a result of the Armenian Renaissance, which was the Zartong, changing of the dynamics of power within the Armenian community after the introduction of the Armenian National Constitution and the formation of the Armenian National Assembly, the rise of the Armenian merchant class, and finally the deteriorating political situation of Armenians in the eastern provinces that led to the emergence of Armenian revolutionary movements. In the case of the Jews, they too experienced major transformation, represented by the changes in the dynamics of power in their community by the introduction of a constitution and the establishment of a general assembly. The impact of the European Haskalah, which was the European Renaissance on the Ottoman Jewry, the proliferation of the education systems in the empire, which was mainly initiated by the Alliance Israélite Universelle, founded in Paris in 1860, and finally Zionism, which shaped the fate of the Jewish people in the empire. Arabs also experienced major changes represented by the rise of Arab notables in the Arab provinces, who assumed the role of intermediaries between the Ottoman state and their localities, the emergence of Arab Renaissance called al-Nahda, represented by the Arab Muslim Christian intellectual movement, and the, finally, the impact of the missionaries in Lebanon, Syria, and Palestine. So, one day prior to the revolution, these divergent groups were living in societal structures that were centuries old. This does not, however, mean that those societies were stagnant. Despite the prevailing status quo, these variegated groups were influenced by global and regional currents of change that affected the gradual transformation of their societies. Nevertheless, the revolution accelerated these transformations and attempted to create a rupture with the previous era. Examining the impact of the revolution on different social groups reveals the deep-rooted antagonism that existed not only within the different stratums of the society in general, but also within the different institutions of society, religious, military, and political alike. These antagonisms would manifest themselves in the post-revolutionary period and demonstrate as to why revolutions are more complex phenomenon than an attempt by many people within the society to topple a government and create a new one. Now, I'll start talking about the impact on the Armenians of the Ottoman Empire. So one of the major changes occurring among the Armenians in the Ottoman Empire after the 1908 revolution was the change of leadership and the transfer of the center of power from the Armenian Patriarchate to the Armenian National Assembly, which was the ANA. The downfall of Patriarch Malachi Ormanian represented the downfall of the Armenian Ancien Regime and the beginning of new era. Thus, the Young Turk Revolution became a milestone in defining intra-ethnic relationships in the empire's Armenian millet. It resulted in a micro-revolution, culminating in the reinstatement of the Armenian National Constitution, the reopening of the Armenian National Assembly, and the election of Matios Izmirilian as Patriarch of Istanbul. The Armenian micro-revolution eliminated competing centers of power more successfully than the larger Young Turk Revolution. This is because whereas the Ancien Regime of the Ottoman Empire during the post-revolutionary period was embodied in Yıldız Palace clique, the Armenian Ancien Regime was embodied in one person, Patriarch Ormanian. Pizan Keçian, the editor of the Armenian daily newspaper Pizantion, described Ormanian's dominance in the community in this way, and I quote, "He was everything, and as Louis XIV said, 'L'état c'est moi,' certainly Ormanian could have truly declared, and I quote, 'I am the patriarch, the patriarchate, religious council, political council, economic committee, financial trustee, judicial committee, and education committee,'" end quote. In addition to garnering resentment for his stronghold on power, Ormanian was also criticized by the Armenian revolutionary groups for his policies in general and his collaboration with Yıldız Palace in particular. These criticisms intensified as a result of rumors about his candidacy for the post of Catholicos in Eçmiadzin. As a result of these attacks, Patriarch Ormanian resigned immediately after the revolution. So the downfall of Ormanian regime was finalized by the re-election of Archbishop Matios Izmirilian on November 4 as Patriarch of Istanbul. As in the capital, local prelates were dismissed by the Armenian population in many parts of the provinces. For example, in Harput, the Armenians succeeded in dismissing their bishop. In Diyarbakir, the local prelate escaped along with his mother, uncle, servants, and four soldiers, leaving behind, and I quote, "the anger and the dismay of the community." The reinstatement of the Armenian National Constitution and the Armenian National Assembly, which became the center of the Armenian policy making in the empire, were important political processes in the post-revolution period. The Armenian National Assembly contained most of the prominent Armenian clerical and lay figures in the empire. This included members of the Armenian political parties, Armenian members of the Ottoman Parliament, and representatives of the Armenian and the representatives of different Armenian societies. An examination of the debates in the assembly, Armenian assembly, sheds new light on the Armenian leadership's position during the post-revolution period up until the counter-revolution, which took place in 1909. These debates revealed the utmost importance was given to the Armenian constitution. Constitutionalism became a key factor upon which the community's affairs were administered. The authority of the Armenian national constitution was even placed above that of the highest Armenian cleric, i.e. the patriarch. partially as a result of this reorientation, the Armenian National Assembly became a mini parliament that, at least in its earlier stages, discouraged partisanship and advocated loyalty to the empire. When he was chosen as the president of the Armenian National Assembly, the famous Armenian figure, political figure Minas Cheras, made the following statement. Delegate, and I quote, delegate reverends and gentlemen, thanks to the reinstatement of the Ottoman constitution, the Armenian constitution, which has been paralyzed by despotism for years, was also reinstated. The rebirth of both constitutions is an equally happy occasion for us, because if it's the call of the Ottoman constitution to administer the affairs of the country according to the principle of justice, it is also the call of the Armenian constitution to administer the national affairs according to principles of justice, principles whose anchor is the popular right, or according to an old expression, the voice of many, the voice of God. In, end quote. In general, three issues dominated the debates in the Armenian National Assembly during the during this period. The first was the establishment of a commission to investigate the ex-Patriarch Ormanian's financial blundering. The second was the question of provinces, the situation of the Armenian provinces in the eastern Armenian provinces in the east, and finally the question of Jerusalem, that I had discussed in detail in a different place. Of these, I think the situation in the provinces proved to be the most urgent issue. One of the major questions facing the Armenian National Assembly during the post-revolution period was the condition of the Armenians in the eastern provinces, otherwise known as the Vilayet-e Sitte, or the six Armenian provinces. In some parts of these provinces, the constitution prevailed within 2 to 3 months of its proclamation. But in other places, the ancien regime continued to rule. For example, the declaration of constitution did not bring about any reform in Mush. On the contrary, the Hamidiya regiments and the Kurdish Ashirets there, affiliated with the ancien regime, oppressed the Armenian population. The case of Mush, for example, attracted much attention in the Armenian press, and assembly members were pressured to respond meaningfully. Likewise, in Bitlis, for example, the announcement of the constitution was followed by violent reaction. The Kurdish farmers, Tith farmers there, continued to oppress the population, and it was stated that the matter would be resolved with the arrival of a new governor, otherwise Vali, known as Vali. Both the reaction of local groups such as the Kurdish Ashirets or the Hamidiya regiments after the revolution and the counter-reaction should be seen in the context of changes in the power dynamics in the eastern provinces, mainly as a result of the revolution. The Young Turk Revolution caused major changes in these dynamics, leading to an erosion of social and political stability. By disturbing precariously balanced power equilibrium, revolution produced a great deal of dissatisfaction within some segments of the population. The condition of the provinces was discussed in depth in the Armenian National Assembly. On October 17, a petition prepared by Assembly's Political Council was submitted to the Assembly, recommending that the government send an investigative commission to the eastern provinces in which the majority of the Armenians would be leaving. So basically, after the debates within the Armenian National Assembly, they sent a bill, a proposal to the Grand Vizier, Kamil Pasha, asking him to send an investigation commission to the eastern provinces. But the whole project was aborted because of the strong Young Turk opposition within the parliament, because Kamil Pasha promises the Armenians that he's going to deal with the condition of the eastern provinces and sends a bill to the parliament, and the parliament aborts that bill. So, let's discuss a bit the Armenian political parties in the post-revolution period. So the revolution also paved the way for the Armenian political parties that were active in exile to return to the empire. Most of the political prisoners connected to these parties were released from prison, and revolutionary groups handed in their weapons. Thus, the revolution transformed these groups from revolutionary groups to legally sanctioned political parties. However, the public sphere in which these groups acted also would contribute to a fierce and sometimes bloody competition between these groups over controlling intra-communal public opinion and the right to represent the Armenian nation. The center of activity of these political groups became Istanbul, from which they issued orders to the provinces. Immediately after the revolution, members of the Armenian Revolutionary Federation, founded in Tiflis in 1890, arrived from exile in Istanbul and began organizing a series of lectures in order to enlighten the public about their party's political and economic platform. The party's major policies were to cooperate with the CUP, the Young Turk Committee of Union Progress, for the preservation and protection of the constitutional regime, to reestablish all branches of the party in the provinces, to create a powerful bloc in the parliament, to return confiscated land that were confiscated during the Hamidian region between 1878 to 1908, and to gradually implement basic administrative cultural decentralization. In the ARF's first public address in Galata in Istanbul on the 23rd of August 1908, famous Taşnak activist Haçadur Marumyan, also known as Agnuni, explained the party line in a capacity crowd. And I quote, "Compatriots," he said, "you are not Ottoman subjects anymore. Rather, you are free Ottoman citizens. You can be sure of the eternity of your freedom. There is not any fear of the reinstatement of the previous regime. The aim of Taşnak Sütun became to create their freedom, this freedom in despotic Turkey. From now on, its effort will be to preserve and spread this freedom at any cost, with cannon, swords, arms, and powder." The different elements that cooperated with Taşnak Sütun at Paris Congress agreed to this idea. Paris Congress referring to the 1907 Congress. Taşnak Sütun will seek to create for Turkey a free federated state on the basis of the principle of coexistential equality, whose different parts, being autonomous, will be supporters of the Ottoman fatherland, end quote. The RF also spread widely in the provinces. In Mush and Van, the party was in control of the local church diocese. In spite of all of this, the Young Turk Revolution presented a major challenge to the revolutionaries in the provinces. It created a revolutionary class whose existence, as the Armenian revolutionary Rufen Derminasyan stated in his memoirs, became an unnecessary thing, and I quote, "a rusted rifle left in a dark corner," end quote, because the revolution had already been achieved. The CUP argued that now that the constitution had been reinstated and freedom proclaimed, there was no need for revolutionary groups. Therefore, they maintained that members of these groups should either be disarmed or enter into the ranks of the Ottoman army. This crisis also was reflected in the relationship between the political center of the Taşnaks residing in Istanbul and the revolutionary fringe in the provinces. While the leadership in Istanbul, most of whom came from Europe, was optimistic about the post-revolutionary period, the leadership in the provinces, the Taşnak leadership in the provinces, was highly pessimistic about the situation, and some were even reluctant to hand in their weapons. The revolution also paved way for other political groups to act in the empire. After the revolution, the Hınçaks, the Social Democratic Hınçakyan Party, leadership returned and to Istanbul and began organizing its branches in the provinces. The Hınçaks had a clear-cut policy: political autonomy for Armenia within the framework of a constitutional empire. They were reluctant to enter into any form of cooperation with the CUP. The Hınçaks' two main aims became establishing branches in the empire and arming the people. They were ready to cooperate and sign agreements with the Taşnaks if the latter openly declared that they had cut all their ties with the Committee of Union and Progress. The other parties that became active in the empire were the Armenian Constitutional Democratic Party, otherwise known as the Ramgavars, found in Alexandria, October 31, 1908, and the Velagazmial Hınçakyan Gusak Sütun, the Reformed Hınçakyan Party. So a fierce and sometimes bloody competition began between these political parties, a state of affairs that was reflected in the Armenian press, in the Armenian National Assembly, and in the Armenian provinces. The Hınçaks and the Ramgavars were extremely critical of the Taşnaks' policy of their relationship with the CUP. After the Adana massacres of 1909, the Taşnaks continued in close relationship with the CUP, leading to a great deal of tension among the different Armenian political parties in the empire. So this was the first section. second section, we're going to see the impact of the Yom Kippur Revolution on the Jews living in the empire. On January 25, 1909, Jacques Ligard, who was the Secretary General of the Alliance Israélite Universelle, Alliance Israélite Universelle, the IEU, known as the most important educational institution found in Paris, played a dominant role in educating the Jews of the East, wrote to the Chief Rabbi of the Ottoman Empire, Haim Nachum, expressing his contentment with the revolution by saying, and I quote, "Thus it may well be said that the whole Turkish revolution is like the triumph of our ideas, ideas that are so moderate, yet so liberal and solely inspired by love of the common good," end quote. So the Young Turk Revolution's impact on the Jews in the empire should be analyzed from two perspectives. One perspective pertains to the micro-level revolution that took place in the empire after the revolution, because the revolution paved the way for the Jewish progressive movements, movement in the empire to start not only reforming their own communities, but also taking active part in the political and economic life of the empire. However, unlike the smooth transition that took place among the Armenian community within the empire, the transition of power within the Jewish community was a bit more difficult than its Armenian counterpart. The Jewish progressive movement's first task then was to take control out of the hands of Rabbi Moshe Halevi, who had occupied his position as the locum tenens without any formal appointment for more than 35 years. On the 17th of August 1908, the progressives succeeded when Nachum was chosen as the locum tenens. This caused agitations and anxiety among the Jewish community of Istanbul. In order to strengthen his position, Haim Nachum paid a couple of official visits to important figures. September 8, for example, he visits Prince Sabahuddin, and on the 10th of September, he visits Archbishop Matthias Ismirilian in order to strengthen his position. It is important to stress here that the fact that the tensions emanating from Nachum's appointment as the chief rabbi is basically the tensions that existed between the Alliance Israelite Universelle and Zionists in the Ottoman Empire. Like the election of locum tenens, the election of the chief rabbi of Turkey occupied the central position within the Jewish press, and on November 24, 1908, Haim Nachum was elected as chief rabbi with 74 votes. He was elected by the support of the Young Turks, despite the fact that his opponent did protest against his appointment. Even prior to his election as the chief rabbi, letters began to pour into the offices of the chief rabbinate from the provinces demanding that Nachum, as locum tenens, dismiss their spiritual leaders because they represented the ancien regime of their communities, the same scenario that happened among the Armenians within the provinces. The Jewish communities of Jerusalem, Damascus, Saida held demonstrations against their rabbis. The governors of these locales also telegraphed the Sublime Porte, arguing in support of the demonstrators. Consequently, the Minister of Justice wrote to the locum tenens demanding to take action without delay. Finally, on September 3, the Secular Council of the Chief Rabbinate, under the presidency of Haim Nachum, decided to dismiss these rabbis. Or these dismissals, the issue of the dismissal of the rabbi of Jerusalem became a major issue, and it became to be known as the question of Jerusalem, something that I've written in a different place. On February 2, 1909, Vladimir Jabotinsky, who later became the father of Reformed Zionism, one of Zionist's most important leaders, wrote an article in the Zionist newspaper Ha'olam, the world, discussing the post-revolution condition. And I quote, "The new situation in Turkey has opened in front of us new and wide horizons, but in order to make use of this situation, it is necessary that we have energy and tactics, and it is difficult to say what's more, tactics or energy," end quote. The 1908 revolution did indeed provide an important opportunity for the Zionists in the empire for the realization of their aim. And as I said, the realization of their aim is the establishment of a Jewish homeland in Palestine. Even prior to the revolution, the Zionists felt that they needed a permanent representative in Istanbul in order to realize their goals. So David Wolfson, the person on the right side, who was the president of the World Zionist Organization, had expressed this view during a meeting in the Inner Action Committee in Cologne, where he reported on his visit to the Ottoman Empire. He argued that there was a serious inclination at the highest levels of the Ottoman government to deal with Zionism, and that the time was ripe for political activity. At the same meeting, Dr. Avigdor Jakobson, a Russian Jew who was director of the Anglo-Palestine Bank branch in Beirut, was appointed to represent the organization in Istanbul and charged with promoting the interests of Zionism among the Ottoman political circles. While these plans were being made, the Young Turk Revolution takes place, opening new possibilities for Wolfson and others who hoped that the Young Turks would not pursue the anti-Zionist policies pursued by their predecessors, meaning by predecessor meaning Sultan Abdulhamid II. Now, Jakobson arrives to Istanbul in August 26, 1909. From there, he communicates with Wolfson 2 to 3 times a week, updating him about the situation. And these correspondences are found in the Zionist archives in Jerusalem. In one of his first letters to Jakobson, Wolfson describes the role that Jakobson needs to play. According to him, Jakobson's immediate task was to gather information about the political condition and conduct a series of important meetings with key figures in both the Jewish community and the Ottoman political milieu, more generally without entering into negotiations. The task involved meetings with the Jewish leaders, communities of the Jewish leaders of Istanbul, Izmir, and Salonika. And in his first letter to Wolfson, Jakobson described the situation in Turkey, expressing his hopes for the promulgation of new laws regarding the purchase of lands that would be beneficial for the Zionist cause. Jakobson, however, wanted to do more active job of promoting the Zionist approach to the empire's Jewish communities and enter into direct negotiations with the Ottoman authorities. In the beginning of 1909, Zionist leadership seemed to be very optimistic about the situation and their activities. One of their main achievements in Istanbul during this period was the mobilization of 2 Jewish parliament members to represent their interest. Jakobson was able to mobilize Nisim Mazliach and Nisim Rousseau, both of whom were influential and expressed a keen interest in Zionism. Wolfson sent a letter in which he thanked them for meeting with Jakobson and maintained that the parliamentary way would be the best path to achieving the aims of Zionism. He also asked them to explain the parliament that Zionism did not have, and I quote, a separatist aspiration, and concluded his letter by urging the Ottoman Jews to defend the Zionist cause. As Zionist influence expanded, one of Jakobson's major tasks became the establishment of a newspaper in Istanbul that would promote Zionist ideas. Of course, we're talking about the post-1908 revolution, where the press plays a dominant role in propagating ideas, in shaping political ideas, and etc. The newspaper would touch on issues pertaining to the Jewish minority, Jewish autonomy, and immigration problems. Jakobson also proposed that a committee be formed in Istanbul to deal with the publicity. It was not until after the counter-revolution in March that such a committee was finally formed. So the power dynamics that emerged in the empire's Jewish community as a result of the revolution were complex. The rise of Chaim Nahum to the rabbinate was a tremendous victory for the progressive movement among the Jews. The revolution also opened up new horizons for the Zionists, but it also created major obstacles for the realization of their goal. The chief rabbi of the empire, Now, Nahum Pasha, the chief rabbi, and David Fresco, who was the editor of El Tiempo newspaper, the Ladino newspaper, became the main opponents of Zionist activities in the empire. In addition to these external threats, Zionists also suffered from serious internal division. As a result of these divisions, the president of the World Zionist Organization pays a visit to Istanbul, and at the same time, the counter-revolution takes place and it halts their activities for a period of time. Now, examining the impact of the revolution on the Arab provinces should be viewed not only from the perspective of the Arab provinces themselves, but also from that of the imperial palace. After all, it is there that the close confidant of the Sultan, who were mainly major figures from the Arab provinces, lost their positions. They played dominant role of intermediaries, keeping a fine-tuned balance between the local notables and the palace. They lost their positions. On first sight, it appears that the revolution did indeed cause serious changes in dynamics of power in the Arab provinces, but making generalizations about the impact of the revolution on these provinces would be, however, misleading. The euphoric feelings and mass demonstrations in the cities of the Arab provinces after the revolution should not be viewed as the beginning of mass movement. Each city was influenced in a different way. For example, the politics in Damascus was not the same as the politics of notables in Beirut or Mount Lebanon or Palestine. Hence, though every locality was influenced by the Young Turk Revolution, the impact varied from district to district depending on local exigencies. When the news of the revolution arrived in the Arab provinces, local authorities received it with reservation and were unwilling to declare the constitution valid. Some were skeptical about the news, while others feared that such a step would lead to the erosion of political and social stability. In addition to local officials, notables and ulema also were stunned by the news. They were afraid that the revolution and the shift of the center of power from the local authorities to the CUP would endanger their traditional sources of legitimacy, power, status, and prestige. These fears certainly had a basis. In fact, after the revolution, CUP branches and clubs mushroomed in Syria, and although these organizations began as local initiatives, they eventually were taken over by the Central Committee of the CUP in Salonika. The CUP branches threatened the notables and the ulema by temporarily becoming the de facto force in the local politics in the Syrian districts during the post-revolutionary political gap. In addition to bringing CUP branches to Syria, the revolution also resulted in the creation of Arab political movements, the first of which was the Arab-Ottoman Brotherhood, established in Istanbul by the dismissed functionaries, Arab functionaries of the ancien regime. For the sake of the time, I'm going to concentrate only on one or two cases. I'm not going to concentrate on Mount Lebanon, only Damascus and Beirut. Among the Arab provinces, Damascus was an important center for the activities of the religious group called the Ulema. In part, this was because of the Umayyad Mosque, a famous center for the mosque in Damascus, made it traditional place of Islamic learning. Additionally, the notables in Damascus, numbering about 50 families, were a powerful force running the political mechanism. As in other localities, the revolution became the ultimate threat to the notables and the new class. They were afraid that the revolution is going to take their power, they're going to lose their position and their prestige within their own societies. So, this transformation was, however, less successful in Damascus than in other areas. The fact that these notables and the ulema in Damascus had more power to be able to control the politics. They used religion and tradition as two important tools to be able to convince and control the people and avoid the fall of the political sphere in the hands of the Young Turks. The temporary political gap created after the revolution was filled by these CUP branches as they began running the affairs of the administration. As it assumed the first task, the CUP in Damascus was to remove the ancien regime officials from the position of power. So basically, after the revolution, all these Arab provinces, their governors, sub-governors, are removed by the local CUP branches and are replaced by CUP members. So many are seeing these as a threat to their prestige and their importance. This antagonism between the ulema notables and the CUP also bore fruit during the parliamentary elections. Now, Beirut is another interesting case. In Beirut, the CUP was stronger than Damascus. It became the sole authority in the city. As elsewhere, the CUP's first task was to move against associates of the ancien regime, particularly the governor, the chief of police, and the commandant of the gendarmerie, along with many other local officials. Telegrams arrived ordering the removal of these functionaries, while local newspapers began campaigning against Beirut's administrative council, calling for its freedom. The Wali of Beirut escaped upon hearing about his dismissal, planning to flee to Cyprus and place himself under the protection of the British. His plan failed, he was arrested, and after being arrested, he and other dismissed officials became spectacle of public humiliation. They were forced to move in a procession towards the harbor, while thousands lined on the streets cursing the Wali and colleagues. I'm not going to discuss the case of Lebanon. It's longer case, but I'm going to conclude here. As I said, first I'm going to provide shorter conclusion, a longer conclusion, and discuss the larger conclusion here. So this lecture aimed at discussing the impact of the Young Turk Revolution on the three ethnic groups by examining the changes in the dynamics of power within them. It contends that post-revolutionary ethnic politics in the Ottoman Empire should not be viewed only from the prism of political parties, but also through ecclesiastic politics, which was a key factor in defining inter- and intra-ethnic politics. Interestingly, despite the fact that the revolution aimed at creating the modern, secular Ottoman citizen, whose loyalty was going to be to the state, it nevertheless strengthened the ethno-religious political centers of the ethnic groups. It did so by creating the space in which fierce competition began among different actors within these communities for control over power positions. I'm not going to conclude the other sections, but so why I use the word shattered? The revolutionary dreams of the empire's non-dominant groups were shattered not only by the CUP's authoritarian tendencies, but also by contradictory dynamics that highlighted the revolutionary and post-revolutionary period. So the grand conclusion is the following. So one thing we need to understand that this CUP, that's my own understanding, the Community of Union Progress, they were not wholeheartedly committed to constitutionalism. For them, constitutionalism and parliament was an aim to serve, to preserve the territorial integrity of the empire. They were imperialists. They wanted to preserve the territorial integrity of the empire. And at the time, constitutionalism and parliamentarism being the major political, let's say, quote-unquote, progressive options, they accepted them in order to use them as a tool for a means. I mean, in any case, we have today authoritarian governments who have constitutions and parliaments. Having constitution and parliament does not necessarily mean that you are progressive politically. Syria is an excellent example of that. Everyone stands and collapses when Bashar enters. That's an interesting thing. Another major issue has to do with CUP's uncritical adaptation, acceptance, and implementation of the constitution. Of course, they tried to use the French Revolution as a model, because French Revolution was an important model for the realization, for the implementation of the Young Turk Revolution in terms of idea, in terms of motto, in terms of lexicon. But one important thing is that they did that by their uncritical implementation, and just accepted it and implemented it. The fourth point is that even on the eve of the revolution, the movement, ideas, and principles were ambiguous. Ambiguity is a major aspect of understanding the Young Turk Revolution. Ambiguity of terminologies, ambiguity of ideas, ambiguity of what do we mean by the revolution, what do we want by the revolution, and this ambiguity is not only pertinent to the Young Turks, but exists across all the ethnic groups. For one, Ottomanism means something, for another person, Ottomanism means another thing. There were a lot of contradictory aspects of the ideals of the revolution. Contradiction yet is another major component that led to the deterioration of the inter-ethnic relationship. Contradiction is embodied in the understanding that the CUP, they had one vision, which is a centralized form of an empire. All ethnic groups are going to be removed from their privileges, church privileges. They're going to adopt Turkish as a first language. And in the parliamentary election, they're not going to be proportional representation, but universal representation. This was the idea of the Young Turks as a means to preserve the territorial integrity of the Ottoman Empire. On the other hand, Armenians, to a certain extent Arabs, to a certain extent mostly Zionists, to a certain extent the Jews, they had a different vision. Their vision was administrative decentralization. They wanted administrative decentralization. They wanted to preserve their church privileges, which they were enjoying for the past 500 years. They wanted to have their own indigenous languages being taught at their school, but accepted that Turkish needs to be taught in the fourth grade or something of that sort. Now, this was a clash of visions between the dominant and the non-dominant groups. And this clash of visions would play a dominant role in the deterioration of the inter-ethnic rule, inter-ethnic relations. And the final thing is that I believe that the Young Turks were themselves authoritarian, because especially after the counter-revolution that took place in 1909, after the counter-revolution and the Adana massacres, the Young Turks realized that by giving too much freedom to the public, they would be losing their territorial integrity of the Ottoman Empire, and eventually would lead to ethnic strife and the autonomy of ethnic groups. Hence, they did not shy away of taking extra legal and extra constitutional measures in order to preserve their own interest as the interest of the CUP, not necessarily the interest of other Turks, the interest of the CUP as a political party, and they did that through authoritarian tendencies by removing people through extra legal measures. So these are some of the conclusions that I arrived in the book, and you can read the book and enjoy it, I should say. I would like to open now for the floor for suggestions.